Visual autokinesis is not the ability to move cars with your eyes. I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome in to the Aero News special feature. Thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. We get together with Bob on Mondays to talk about safety-related issues. And Bob, you had a great list of things about night operations in the newsletter. And first, thanks for joining us today.
Well, it's my pleasure, Paul.
Well, let's talk about some of these things that can affect you in night operations. Obviously, in the Northern Hemisphere at this time of year, we're into periods of more extended nighttime operations. I've experienced a couple of these personally, but it's good to run down the list. Let's start with what visual autokinesis is.
Visual autokinesis is something that it's fairly common, and that is if you stare at a light, a single light outside the cockpit for any length of time, several seconds actually, the light begins to move around in your brain, and it does it because there's no reference point to like a background to sight it off of, and a light on the ground or even a star may appear as if it's an aircraft moving towards you or away from you, and it's the only thing you can do is avoid, you know, staring at a specific light for any length of time. Keep your eyes moving around and try to develop a visual reference point outside. Related to this, there was some thought that back that terrible fatality involving JFK Jr. Some of the experts had quipped that had he seen only a single light out in front of him, he would not have known for certain whether it would be a star or a boat. So lights at night, you know, they are oftentimes our only point of reference. And when they begin dancing around in our brain, this is something that we have to be cautious to respond to accordingly.
Well, in my days as a student flying around the Oregon coast, I flew out over the coast and experienced that. I know that sometimes a boat looks like the sky and vice versa.
Yeah.
False horizons, the specific instance you mention is something that would happen more in northern latitudes than it would anywhere else, but talk about that.
Well, I mentioned the false horizon created by the northern lights, and this is a unique glow that occurs on some evenings, as you pointed out, in the northern hemisphere, but just taking off and catching a glimpse of the horizon by moonlight against the cloud background when the cloud deck isn't uniformly level, so that you look at the cloud deck through the glow of the moonlight, the deck begins to appear as if it's a horizon, but it in turn is somewhat slanted. It's not even, and we adjust our wings to that uneven cloud bank or false horizon, as it's called, and we can wind up in a long turn. And this is, you know, if we're following a GPS course, this is fine. We can always compensate. But if we're using old-fashioned dead reckoning, where we're, you know, trying to follow a compass course or a course on a heading indicator, and we're in a subtle turn, we can find ourselves off course in very short order.
Well, and your solution is trust our instruments, and that's very hard for some people to do, especially if they're non-instrument rated pilots who find themselves out and experiencing this at night.
Well, you know, night presents a unique challenge to the VFR-only pilot. I mean, how many times we take off over a dark desert or dark water, or just dark forested terrain, we have no visual horizon. And we are really in instrument conditions, even though the weather service says the weather is VFR. I don't think anybody should launch at night in today's day and age without a moving map GPS. And better yet, a moving map GPS like a Garmin 430 or any of the handhelds, a 295, 395, 495, that will give you a depiction of the heading indicator so that you know immediately when you're banking. You know, there are a number of folks who recommend no night flight at all unless you're instrument rated. Now, I wouldn't go so far to say that, but as we're talking about in this subject, the night flight can put you into instrument meteorological conditions, even though it's technically VFR outside. There's been a number of fatal wrecks I know in the Florida coastline where they take off to the west off of Naples, for example, or out of Fort Lauderdale to the east and go right out over the water and have no horizon whatsoever. And all they have are hopefully some stars and maybe a boat out there, but it's a unique challenge.
Okay, let's talk about Flickr vertigo. This is something that I recall reading about years ago. I can't say I've ever experienced it.
Flickr vertigo is more of an effect on instrument pilots in the clouds. We are taught, and it's a wise thing to do, to turn off the strobe lights when we're in the clouds because something is happening in the brain with that blinking, that constant blinking out of the peripheral, out of our side vision. And it can cause, as I pointed out in the article, some nausea, some dizziness, grogginess, a little bit of vertigo. It's just an effect that happens physiologically in the presence of blinking lights. And you can imagine some of the scenes of psychedelic music in a darkened auditorium where all of a sudden they get the strobe lights going very quickly. And it can cause indeed a physical reaction that when on the ground watching a concert is one thing, but when trying to keep an airplane upright in the clouds solely by reference to the instruments, and then we have this going on, it can create a tremendous hazard. Solution, try to eliminate any source of blinking. Certainly turn off the strobe lights once inside the clouds because they're, as I said, they're flickering back into the cabin. If you see flickering lights on the ground, try to avoid, staring at them.
Let me ask you about a couple of questions I have left after that explanation. How about a couple of specific flickering lights that we can't always do much about, one being your transponder, the other being lights on the horizon? Are those not enough to be what we're talking about here?
Yeah, the hits on the transponder, I don't think that would be an issue. But if there are lights outside, there's a lot of talk about laser light damage to the pilot's eyes. That, too, is a source not only for the potential damage it does to the retina of the eye, but it's an extremely bright light out there that if you capture it, straight on, it can be sickening in the way it strikes us. So these are, again, what we call these night illusions that are significantly different than daytime flight. And the solution for that is, of course, doing lots of night flight. Get up there, get used to it, become aware of these illusions. One that we did not talk about that perhaps is the most threatening in terms of life and death would be that black hole approach that is another one of these illusions where we're landing over our very darkened final approach course. We look straight down and there's just absolutely no sign of the ground. To the instrument pilot flying on a glide slope, this is not a big issue because we're staying on a glide slope. But for the VFR pilot flying, this can be a really sucker hole where we think we're much higher than we really are, and it just quite literally sucks us down into a very low approach and eventually puts us in the trees. Unless I'm on an instrument approach with vertical guidance, going into an airport at night without a VASI or a PAPI, the dual, triple, sometimes four light systems that indicate visually whether we're high or low in the glide path, without those in an unfamiliar airport, the only solution would be to come in with a fairly steep descent to avoid a low approach, and then you've got the problem of how to slow the airplane down on a short runway. So I keep coming back to the fact that night operations are indeed different than daytime operations, and one of the short-sightedness of the private pilot standards is we're only required to have 3 hours of night training out of our total of 40 or more hours of training. So if you're not accustomed to flying at night and you want to do that, then find a competent instructor, go out and just work through each of these illusions until you recognize what they are and how to deal with them.
Well, and obviously the other issue with a steep approach at night, especially if you're not current or proficient at that kind of operation, is that flares look different at night as well. When we come back from the break, Bob, let's talk about a couple of other things you mentioned in this article before we get away. Bob Miller is my guest. Over the Airwaves, the Journal for the Proficient Pilot, is his newsletter. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Paul Plack, and you're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
Diamond's DA-42 Twin Star is General Aviation's ultimate flying machine. Fly fast with the confidence of a twin for the cost of a single. Go direct over water or rugged terrain and cover great distances in the first and only piston aircraft with an advanced airframe, avionics, and engines. The DA-42 gives you options you've never had before, including the Garmin G1000 and no ice protection. Go where you want, when you want, fast and for less. Visit Diamond on the web at www.diamondair.com or call 888-359-3220.
Welcome back to the Aero News Special Feature. Paul Plack here with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, talking about specific risks involved in flying at night, which, at least in the Northern Hemisphere, we do more of at this time of the year. And Bob, you talk about night light adaption. And one of the things that I learned about the human eye was the human eye's sensitivity to light over a period of 30 minutes going from brightness to total darkness experiences an increase in sensitivity to light of 100,000 times.
Yeah.
So obviously the first thing you mentioned on your list here of things to make night flying safer is to make sure we give ourselves that 30 minutes.
Night light adaption. Clearly, when we're getting into an airplane, particularly around a larger airport where there are, on the ramp areas, bright lights, try to, dim the cockpit lighting. And if necessary, be sure that you're in the cockpit on the ground for at least a full 20 minutes, if not a little bit longer. In most cases, we are getting prepared to take off so that light can, so our eyes can adapt. But one of the things that I wish we had more awareness of, and that is the damage that our own landing or taxi lights or strobe lights can do to a fellow pilot who's approaching us on the ground or who's taking off or, in fact, who's landing. You know, if you're departing on an active runway and you're taxiing up on a parallel taxiway, a tail dragger in particular, but any airplane can, with their strobe light, can be damaging to the eyes of the pilot on final approach to landing. Not permanently damaging, but it can affect their night lighting adaptation. So care of our own lighting, what it does to other pilots. Another thing that we can do is something that I do, and I used to blame it on my age, but further reading I've done on the subject, the use of supplemental oxygen during night flight. Supplemental oxygen bottles are now becoming very affordable. They're easy to acquire. They're easy to handle and deal with in the airplane. Even though you don't plan on flying higher than 6,000 or 8,000 feet, putting on supplemental oxygen has a tremendous effect on our visual acuity. They say our eyes are demand a rich oxygen blood supply to focus properly. And even down as low as 5,000 feet at night, supplemental oxygen is useful. And then for us, and I say us, older pilots or pilots who smoke or pilots who have other conditions, using supplemental oxygen all the time at night is not a bad idea. It just increases our visual acuity. And then I put out there a challenge.
This one was interesting, Bob. I can't imagine you would make this if you didn't know you're going to win.
What's that? Oh, yeah. Well, under Part 91, nobody's won yet. I mean, for general aviation, there's talking about air transport operations, Part 121 airline operations. But for the GA pilot, the list of equipment required for night flight, you'll nowhere in the world will you find, or in the FARs, any reference to the need to carry a flashlight. This is perhaps the most useful of all equipment that we can have on an airplane. And again, it points to, and I made a quip there, anybody who places their aviation safety solely in the hands of the regulations is a fool. As long as I meet the requirements of the FARs, I'm safe. But that's not the case. And I was prepared to give away as many free subscriptions to Over the Airwaves as I had winners, but we didn't have a winner.
Well, Bob, isn't it free to get Over the Airwaves anyway?
Yeah, but hey, what the heck? People like to win.
All right, well, Bob, as always, we appreciate your provoking our thoughts, and this is a particularly timely one. We'll refer people to the November issue of Over the Airwaves, and we'll talk to you again on Monday.
Thanks, Paul.
Bob Miller has been my guest. Find the current edition of the newsletter at overtheairwaves.com. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.